You know what success is actually made of? You know what we call pure, raw, unmoulded success? We call it failure. Turns out failure is just unrefined, unsculpted pre-successfulness. So, welcome to the Pre-Successful Writers Podcast.
So, lads, what you been writing this week?
Whoa, straight
we're
in there,
we're not doing hellos and stuff like that.
Off the top.
We're not having like, chit-chat, little bit of banter. No, come on.
Do you know what? This will surprise you. This really will. Funny story. Nothing whatsoever. Do you know what? I've been writing songs.
Oh, really?
All week.
Advert songs.
Yeah,
right.
Songs, advert Jingles. Songs. But yeah, no, I haven't actually written. I've kept meaning to write some Poker Night stuff, but I just haven't had, not had a moment. And I went away at the weekend and I got really drunk and I just, you know. So no, the answer is I haven't written anything. How about you, Tom?
Yes, not only have I written some things on our Poker Night screen, I've also been watching John write on our Poker Night screen.
Because
we're doing it on Google Docs.
Has it happened?
It's all finished, yeah. It's sorted now, David. We've done it.
No, I mean, did it happen that you were both on there at the same
time? Yeah, happened a few times. We've been writing simultaneously.
Because you see stuff getting
it's
written.
Been really good fun.
Well, the first time, John was typing away, and I literally just changed two words just for comedy effect. But yeah, I've mostly been going through just deleting his double space habit.
It's awful. I can't not do it. I'm really trying not to.
You only do it in certain places. You don't do it everywhere.
I know, because I'm sort of aware of it.
It's like in a it's like in a run of a little.
Yeah. It's those few extra years older, aren't you, John? So
exactly. That's my excuse.
Typewriting.
It's been really interesting, actually. You know, we've been talking this season about collaborative writing and all that business, but it just brought, I guess, an unexpected aspect to it that maybe we should have expected. But they're doing it on Google Docs, where it's all live up on Google's cloud. We were just kind of, there was a bit where I was editing a bit that we'd done and John was writing some new stuff, and then you'd scroll down, you see the new stuff and you think, that's good, and you think, I can think of a bit to put in there, and you kind of embellish a joke or whatever. It's really quite enjoyable.
I feel really left out now.
Yeah, you need to. We should, next time we just happen to be on, or maybe we actually organise
the time. Had you planned to be there?
No, not at all.
Or did it just happen?
Yeah, it's happened about three times.
Dipping out of it.
I did think, though, this could end up being the longest sitcom episode ever, because it's not really going anywhere. It's going to end up like one of those 70s prog rock.
You get it all
the funny stuff. That's what I figure, but there's not a lot of story at the moment. It's just stuff. It's quite childish stuff that makes Tommy and I laugh.
I think Dan Aykroyd's first draft of the Blues Brothers was 10 hours long, so you know you got to get bits in there, and then you can stay back, can't you?
It definitely needs refining, but it's
better than it being
fun.
Better than it being 10 minutes long and thinking, can't think of anything else. Literally nothing else to add. So.
It does seem to be flowing quite easily.
It is flowing. I think you're being a bit harsh on it there.
Yeah, no, I'm not really.
The story's bubbling under and the characters are doing what they need to do and saying the right...
The characters are being developed.
They're saying the right things, aren't they, and showing the colours.
Also, you say that it's a lot, but if you average it over the number of days that we've been working on this project, it's like a word. A word a day, isn't it? So
good point.
Oh, well, I'm glad you two have been writing stuff, and I look forward to reading
it. Well, don't just read it, Dave. Get dipping
in. I will.
Join in.
Have a little tweet, a little read, and
Well.
So, fellas, we've had a slight shift in what we're doing today, haven't we?
A change of plan.
Things have fallen into place, haven't they?
Yeah.
Stars have aligned.
In rather a nice way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One star in particular. As aligned,
Tell us about it, Tommy. Tell us about it.
So this week we are talking to Lucy Porter, comedian Lucy Porter. Sorry, John, you were going to say,
comedian Lucy
Porter? But I kind of ruined
it. Yeah, you just cut me off, yeah.
But yes, that's the one. And she was meant to be on a few weeks ago, but...
Let's not mention that, though.
And anyway, she really nice of her. She got back in touch. She was very apologetic and said, but then our guest that we were going to have on dropped out yesterday morning with COVID. So hopefully she will get better and we'll have her back. Well, that sounds like, hopefully she won't die. She'll come out. That didn't come out right. I hope she doesn't die, actually. I'm going to stick by that.
It was the right thing to say.
Yeah.
But at the wrong moment.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I got the email from Lucy. I thought, oh, hold on a minute. Would you be available tomorrow night? And she was like, yes. So we're like, way, brilliant. So here we are. We got to spend some time and have a really good chat with Lucy Porter. Anybody want to say anything before we go into the interview there? Or are we just going to...
That sounded perfect.
Should we just go into the interview?
That sounded...
Beautiful. Yeah, let's
just
do it.
Go straight in.
Go.
We don't need to waffle around, do we? Just...
Roll VT.
Get in there.
I feel like I should have probably edited this bit out now, but that somehow stayed in there as well. Anyway, here's Lucy Porter. So welcome to the Failing Writers Podcast, Lucy Porter. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I feel like we should do a little joke about you not turning up the first time, but I don't know if that would be unprofessional or whether we should mention it.
Do you know what? I was so heartened and grateful because I listened to the one that I was meant to be on and I was like, oh, you didn't say we've been let down by this.
No, I mean, John wanted to really lay into you. We had to like properly hold him back.
Oh, I know.
I said, no, come on, let's be professional.
You would have been well within your rights. But yeah, I mean, I'm not only a failing writer, I am a failing podcaster and a failing everything. I just fail.
Failing turn up.
Yeah.
Have you been let down by some key people on your... I bet you've never been let down, have you?
Never in my life. I've just had a charming... No, I know, it's so annoying when you do podcasts and people don't turn up. And yeah, we have had that on our podcast as well. And it's... But, you know, post-COVID, it is that thing where you just think, well, yeah, everybody's doing it from their bedroom. And sometimes, you know, things get in the way. I was at the last time I ended up going to a thing at my kid's school and then... sort of opening my phone in the middle of the headmaster's speech and going, oh shit, just loud enough for everyone around me to hear.
I think most people though are probably more professional than us in that they've got something, you know, that they can fall back on.
I think you could have just ended that sentence.
That's the thing. We actually...
whereas we were just waiting and then went, oh God, we've got to come up with something now.
But that was literally the only time we could record that week as well. So there was, once you'd not turned up, there was a little bit of panic that set in.
It was kind of
all
fun.
But you know what? I listened to it and as you said, you know, it honed your improvisational skills, which I think is a gift that I've given you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Oh, you had it all planned. Wow. Okay. That's amazing. You're an amazing person, Lucy. Thank you.
Yes. I encourage in so many different ways. Yeah, you know, there's sometimes you need just that little shove off the cliff to allow you to fly. And that's what I did.
It literally was.
Well, thank you for joining us now. Yeah.
But it's lovely to be here. And thank you for your patience.
So do you consider yourself to be failing at any point then still?
I mean, surely everybody... I mean, I have listened to some of your back catalogue, but not all. But I would imagine surely everybody who comes on this podcast says that being a failing writer is to be a writer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's drawers full of half-finished projects and there's ideas that you never wrote up. And there
I know,
are...
we know, we still are on the search for the cockiest bastard writer in the world who will come on and go, no.
Everything I touch
is
gold.
I mean, no, everything's gone fine. Yeah. Just...
I think the only sort of, I suppose with stand-up, it's much easier to kid yourself that you're not failing. Because you know, if you turn up and do a show, even if you haven't written or prepared, you can normally do something and then you can sort of go, oh, yeah, well, that went pretty well, actually, yeah, you know, and kid yourself.
Well, hold on a minute, Lucy. Is that not someone who's quite good at saying that? Because I'm sure there's people that aren't quite as good at it who turn up and go, oh, well, I'll just ad-lib a bit and don't come off going, well, that went quite well.
Well, there are times when it doesn't go well. But I think, again, that's the beauty of having been around for decades as well. I mean, the other thing about, because I never really want to call myself a writer because I barely ever write anything down.
All right, okay.
But I sort of think, but I've sort of written enough things in that, you know, I've done loads of stand-up shows. Mm. So there has been writing involved in that. So I kind of feel like the two things you need in show business are talent and longevity. And the nice thing about getting old is you go, well, I've got one of those things. And so it makes it a lot easier to, you know, I think I always had terrible imposter syndrome.
Right.
And then just by dint of the fact that I've been around for so long, it that eases
now,
it.
Now you're quite cocky.
Yeah, very, good. Very. You should see me. I'm sitting here swaggering. Yes.
Lording it over.
I've got a cigar in one hand and a whiskey in the other, just counting my money.
So in terms of the writing then, what does writing look like when you're putting together new material?
Oh, I mean, it doesn't look like writing at all, but right. In the way that I think a lot of writing doesn't. And what I like at the moment is, like, on social media, I see lots of posts from writers saying, you know, loading the dishwasher is writing, going for a walk is writing. And it's true, I think, in all writing, but especially with stand-up, that you can convince yourself that anything you're involved in is in some way helping you towards your next show.
Yeah, it's a thing. It's potentially
everything is
bit,
and potentially tax deductible in that sense as well. So.
Yeah, just doing the shopping. Yeah, tax deductible.
Yeah, all working.
Does that mean, Lucy, you don't sit down at a desk and just sort of start writing? Is it like you're filling a notebook full of funny things, or what does it look like? I'm still confused.
Yes. Well, look, for stand-up, there's no sort of... I used to sit down and have the moment of dread of opening the laptop or firing up the, you know, the old, whatever it was, the old Amstrad emailer or whatever back in the day.
BBC.
Yes. I used to put a cassette into a cassette deck and
crank
that. Yeah, but on. I mean, now it is, you know, if you saw my notes on my phone and my voice memos and bits of paper around the bedroom. And it's always been that with me, that I don't have the capacity really to sit down and write a show from start to finish. And I'm always amazed when people do, like Richard Herring, like when I've worked quite a lot with him. I used to share a flat with him in Edinburgh, and he has a script for his stand-up show and he, in preview, will read out the script and mark it and go, yeah, that worked, that didn't work or whatever. Mm. Whereas I turn up with... You know, like, do you remember in Black Books when Bernard goes to his accountant with a sort of bag full of receipts? And that's my accountancy and also my writing. They're all the same. And thank God, you know, you can get audited by the Inland Revenue, but you can't get audited by any sort of stand-up
the
body.
Comic police.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's terrifying.
I suppose there is also, there's an element as well with stand-up, isn't it? Is that presumably it's kind of always a work in progress as well. You do a show, and if something works, you keep it. If it doesn't, you can change it a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, my shows change. So, taking as an example the Edinburgh Festival, which is where, you know, every year I start a new stand-up show, which I then normally take on tour the next year or, you know, later on. And the show that I start off with at the beginning of August in Edinburgh and the show that I end up with after 3 or 4 weeks is, I mean, massively different. And then when I go on tour, it changes as well. And I mean, that's what I like about it, because I'm someone who is allergic to sort of routine and stability and all those sort of good things. But the nice thing about stand-up is that what's been interesting to me recently is a lot of comedians do work in progress shows and I never feel the confidence to sort of say, like, all my shows are work in progress. But I sort of, so I never kind of delineate. I'm like, it's always going to be different. And I, you know, I like that about it. And especially actually with the pandemic. So I started doing a show 2019 in Edinburgh. I did a show called Be Prepared, which I was then going to tour early 2020.
Was that you dressed in a brownie outfit?
That was, because it was all about the scouts and the guides and the brownies and everything. And so I had to obviously stop doing that show after about 2 dates of the tour. It all got pulled, which was remarkably embarrassing, having to put up big signs everywhere saying Be Prepared has been cancelled due to unforeseen circumstances. And so when I then did get to take it back on tour, so everything obviously got rescheduled and rescheduled. And the show that I did post-pandemic was a very different show to the one that I'd been intending to tour. And I think, again, with stand-up, that's the thing, is that events can intervene, even if you're not, like, I'm not a particularly political or topical comic, but are always surfing the zeitgeist to a certain extent. And, you know, things change and you have to adapt. And
there's certain things you can't really ignore, isn't there? The pandemic was probably quite a large thing that probably needed some mention of some sort.
Yeah, and that weird thing of trying to work out how much, though, because people didn't want you to talk about it because they'd just been through it, and maybe in a couple of years they will want you to, but at the moment it really feels like you need to address it, but not too sort of on the nose. You need to kind of have sort of little glancing references to, oh, well, you know, we've all had a funny couple of years, haven't we? And
A bit of shared experience
exactly. Because everyone had such different experiences as well. I think that's a thing with stand-up as well, is that it's, you know, the good thing about it is that you tell your story and, you know, it's very personal to you. But then you do also have to be mindful that, you know, I think with the pandemic particularly, some people had an amazing time and some people loved it. And financially, they didn't suffer and they got to spend more time with their families and they learned how to make sourdough and, you know, they learned languages. And it, like, and then some people lost family members, lost their livelihoods. You know, I mean, it's such a weird thing that you...
I guess some people lost family members and learned how to do sourdough and just don't know how to feel about
Yes, imagine.
some weird, like, hint, yeah. In between them.
I've baked so many tribute loaves to those who we've lost. Yeah. But that's the nice thing about stand-up, I think. And I mean, I guess in terms of talking about writing and the process, it's like that sense of satisfaction and achievement that you get when you send off a first draft or a final draft or a screenplay or, you know, whatever it is. You never get that with stand-up. You never get that feeling of, right, ta-da!
What's that done?
Mm. Yeah. But then in a way that's good, because then you never also get that sense of, oh, God, it's gone now and I can't do anything about it.
It's interesting. You say you're sort of not into kind of topical stuff, but our writing paths have crossed once in the briefest and most insignificant of ways, because the first and one of the very few things I ever got paid to write was a one-liner on Parsons and Naylor's Pull-Out Sections, which you worked on many years ago. What was that sort of experience like? Because you were writing quite a bit for that, weren't you, over the sort of different seasons?
Yeah, so that was a really happy little ship. I love doing that. Did you come down to the recording?
No. I got sent a cheque for £25 or whatever it was, and went to the pub.
That's more than I made over seven series.
Dave, what was your line?
Do you know what? I can't remember. I know it's something to do with Prince.
Oh, come on.
It was something to do with Prince Charles and a birthday card, but I can't.
Well, it sounds bloody hilarious,
it does,
mate.
Yeah, let's just pretend that it was the highlight of the show.
I remember that. Do you know what? We stopped the recording for the standing ovation.
That's right now. Yeah.
And people were saying, if only the writer were here, we could carry him around the room at shoulder height.
Yeah.
But
yeah, no, that would have been Dave's job. Definitely.
That was
a weird job, because I was a writer on it, and then I also sort of did bits of performing in it, but and sort of topical, but then sketches, and so there was a lot of gear shifts in that of, am I writing topical or not, and am I a performer or a writer this week? And it's quite good to get a sort of all-round view of something, though. It's nice when you have more than one role on something.
Yeah, I was going to say, that must have been quite a good broadening of the skill sets.
Yeah, because I originally just wanted to be a writer and I had no interest in performing whatsoever. In fact, I was incredibly shy, and really I only got into performing as a way to try and get on with writing, and then I sort of ended up like being seduced by the crazy glamour of being on Parsons and Naylor's Pull-Out Sections and eating sandwiches in a green room in Twickenham.
What did you want to write?
Well, originally I wanted to be a journalist, a serious journalist, and I did some training with the Big Issue in the north, because I went to Manchester University and did a English degree. But then I couldn't really afford to go to, because all my friends went off to like Cardiff and places to do journalism, and I sort of just had to get a job, and ended up getting a job at Granada Television, which was amazing. I mean, I did loads of temping and various things, and then I got sort of started getting work at Granada in TV as a researcher, as they call it, production assistant. And and then I was really lucky. My sort of huge, great, lucky moment in life was that Caroline Ahern sort of got me a job and took me under her wing and encouraged me. And her writing team were amazing and they were all really supportive. And I sort of started tentatively doing a bit of stand-up and then sort of never looked back, really.
Wow.
How did that first show go?
Well, so my first ever show was at Alexander's Jazz Bar in Chester. And it was a night run by the Comedy Police, who were these two guys who dressed up in police uniforms. And the audience, it was like a sort of open mic gong show type thing. So if the audience didn't like you, then they'd go, woo, woo, woo. And then the Comedy Police would come and beat you off the stage with their rubber truncheons. But I didn't get beaten off that night. And so I lived to tell the tale, and then I started sort of doing more stuff. But it was an amazing time to be doing stand-up in Manchester, because it was like there was the older generation, which was Caroline Ahern and Steve Coogan and John Thompson and people, and then there were sort of, I started out with people like Chris Addison and Johnny Vegas, and I mean Peter Kay kind of, although I mean, he basically was like, he did a couple of open spot gigs and then immediately was kind of headlining his own shows because he was such a sort of force of nature. But yeah, so I mean, I was part of this really incredibly sort of nurturing and kind comedy scene. And I think that's one of the really key things for me about writing, is that I think you have to always collaborate. And even though stand-up is a very solitary pursuit in many ways, you need to have your peers, or you know, just some sense of there's people you can bounce things off, or who are going through the same stuff as you. And that was like really lovely for me, was that I was, because I think London, even then, so we're talking in the 1990s, late 90s, and like London was already quite a big scary place to do comedy, whereas Manchester just had enough comedians to make a scene, but not make a scene in a, you know, you know what I mean, make a comedy scene, not we made a scene, but yeah, not so many that it was intimidating.
And what was it like as a woman in that time? It was sort of the in-betweeny time, wasn't it, from the dank working men's club comedy circuit to the kind of the mainstream?
Yes, to the lovely smorgasbord of diversity that we enjoy today. Yeah, it was definitely there was only really, there was me and a woman called Susan Vale, who were the two female comedians of Manchester at that time. So I mean, in a way it was, you know, pros and cons. Obviously audiences were still a little bit hostile or surprised when, you know, you did get the kind of people going, oh, the strippers turned up, which is always a joy. But but yeah, there were sort of like Caroline Ahern, as I say, was in sort of incredibly important person in my life, and she was sort of blazing a trail in so many ways. And then there were, you know, Joe Brand and Donna McPhail, who no longer does comedy, but she was she did a lot of stuff in Manchester as well. So yeah, it was quite good. But I mean, there was, yeah, I mean, it was, I do, one of my sort of classic memories is of doing a gig where I was getting paid for, like, you know what it's like where you start off doing comedy and you have to do open spots where you don't get paid, and then eventually, you know, people will take a risk on you. And I think I was booked to do this gig where I was getting paid £20 to do 5 minutes, which was unimaginable riches. Wow. I was very excited, but I turned up, and as I stepped onto the stage, a load of blokes in the audience just started going, get your toots out, get your toots out, get your toots out for that. And I did not know what to do because I was so new and so green. And so what I ended up doing was I conducted them singing this lovely tune, and I was sort of, it was like a sort of Welsh male voice choir where I was sort of bringing voices up from, you know, get your toots out for the lads, for the lads. And it was, and then I sort of looked at my watch and I'd done my 5 minutes. And I was like, great, thank you very much, and good night.
£20,
so, yeah, easiest £20 I've ever earned, I think. Wow. But so, yeah, so there was sort of, yeah, wow. I mean, it was a kind of weird time, because also, in some ways, like obviously being a woman, that, you know, you were a bit unusual, but there was definitely a bit more of a sense that anything goes, and it wasn't, because comedy at that time, again, you know, we were sort of falling between on TV, that era of the comedians and the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Club. And
yeah, that's what I mean. It was kind of, it was like properly in between, wasn't
it? Yeah, and then it wasn't quite Newman and Baddiel, rock and roll, you know, that was starting to happen, but there wasn't a sense that this is going to be a career in any meaningful sense. So you didn't feel, I think comedians now feel a bit more pressure to have a career plan and, you know, I'm going to do three years and then go to Edinburgh and then, all of that. Whereas to us, it was just, we'll just muck about and have a laugh. And there were, you know, just ridiculous acts. There were, you know, like Chris Luby used to stick fireworks up his bottom, and there was a man who used to wear sort of aeroplanes on his head and do a kind of Red Arrows flyby. There was just lots of craziness, and especially like in the Northwest, you have people like Hovis Presley, who was a brilliant comedy poet, but you know, completely didn't play the showbiz game at all. And I mean, Johnny Vegas, actually, when he started out, what was really lovely about his ascent was that he like baffled people and infuriated them, and we all loved him, but there was a sense of like, what is he doing? And then obviously then his time came and everyone went, oh, now we get it. Oh yeah, that's great. But I think, I don't know, in some ways you were freer to take risks.
Sounds almost more like vaudeville or something, you know, like different unusual acts coming on.
Yeah, special acts, because you don't really get so many special acts. There was, what was the guy? Oh, I can't remember his name, but there was a guy who used to come on and say nothing and just wrap the microphone cord around his neck and just, you know, a lot of weird physical stuff. And there was a guy called Stan Vernon who used to just sing ridiculous, surreal songs. And and there was a guy called Smug Roberts. In fact, Smug Roberts, who is still going, he's a great comic, but he used to... There was a night at the Frog and Bucket where he used to take us out on adventures. So we'd go on the trams, because Manchester just got the trams, and he'd take us out and just do a gig on the trams. And, you know, I mean, it must have been really irritating for the good people of Manchester, but it felt like a sort of, like you were part of a sort of art scene.
Are you a kind of a scholar of the art of comedy? Do you know what I mean? There's some comedians almost... They enjoy analysing what makes different kinds of joke funny and all the terminology of jokes and stuff like that. Or do you take a bit more of an instinctive approach?
Well, you know, because you were saying about the, you know, I was listening to you talking about the different styles of, you know, stand-up isn't just one entity. You've got observational, whimsical, one-liners, character, musical. And I do love to spot the sort of similarities and differences in different styles of comedy. And also, like, what I think is brilliant about stand-up is that you can have people who are ostensibly doing similar things. So, say, for example, like one-liner merchants. So if you look at, I don't know, Tim Vine, Gary Delaney, Jimmy Carr, like, they're all, and, you know, Milton Jones, they're all sort of doing one-liners, but they're imbuing that with different personalities and... You know, and you watch them and you immediately get a sense of who they are, even though you could probably sort of share jokes between them quite freely. And all of that sort of stuff I absolutely love. I just love, I love the fact that stand-up is so, like, the balance between material and persona and confidence and delivery and sort of trying to unpick what's the most important. And I'm sure, you know, the jury's still out on that, because you can have amazing comedians with terrible material and, you know, terrible comedians with amazing material, but it's not all about delivery, but a lot of it is. I think the older I get and the more I see, the more I think, like, I now see a lot of stuff that I wish I'd known when I'd started out, and it's too late for me, but I kind of feel I want to sort of tell younger comedians, don't make the mistakes that I have made.
I suppose it's all part of finding your persona, though, isn't it? Like, how did you sort of cope with that? Or do you think it took you a while to sort of get into your sort of comfortable skin on stage?
Oh, ages and ages. And I mean, I'm not even sure that I'm still there, because I think the big thing that I would say with stand-up is that the audience within a couple of seconds have made a load of assumptions about you, and it's really helpful for you to give them some assistance in that. And I never knew who I was, because the thing that every generation of stand-up there are the role models who everybody is kind of impersonating a little bit. So for me, in my generation, it was Eddie Izzard.
Right.
So everybody essentially had watched, you know, Le Singe dans l'Arbre and gone, oh, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do the Star Wars canteen routine. I'm going to do something like that. I'm going to be a bit surreal and I'm going to just, you know, kind of leave loads of pauses and, you know. And then after my generation, it was kind of, I think it was Daniel Kitson for a while was the dominant force that everybody had that sense of slightly bewildered outrage. And then I think now it's probably James Acaster. You see a lot of James Acaster tribute acts. And until they find their voice, they're just basically being James Acaster on stage. And I think, you know, that's inevitable because you're going to have your heroes and people you look up to. But I think, yeah, the really important thing is find the thing that is distinctive about you, and do you, and wear a funny hat, guys. I mean, that's the real
so simple.
Have something physically identifying, because every comedy night you go to, at the end of it, people go, you know, and if like friends of mine now, if they go to see comedy, obviously I always say, oh, who did you see? And they go, oh yeah, there was a guy who no, I can't really remember anything about him, he was very funny, and then there was like someone who, and then but and then there was this guy with like really mad hair and a really loud shirt, and he did one-liners, and I'm like, that was Milton Jones that you saw there. And it just, I think anything that, you know, from Tommy Cooper to Eric Morecambe's glasses, you know, you go, if there's a thing that's that really you true, can be associated with, then that's great. And I never had that. And I think I did, one of the things that I sort of regret, but it was kind of inevitable, was that I did not know how to be as a woman on stage. So I sort of started off kind of, because the real prevailing mood at the time was people saying, oh God, women on stage, all they ever talk about is periods and how much they hate men. And I kind of brought into that being quite young and naive. And I was like, oh God, boy, I must, what I must do is not be a female comedian. I just want to be a comedian. I don't want to be a female comedian. And so I kind of never addressed sort of being a woman. And sort of tried, I don't know, I sort of had lots of weird stuff going on where it all sort of felt like I don't really know who I am or who I'm trying to be.
Yeah.
And I think and I hope that it is easier now and that people are a lot more sort of confident in their own, you know, finding their own voice.
How would you define your own comedy if you wanted to pigeonhole yourself completely?
Well, now I think I'm a sort of... Well, someone in a review in Edinburgh a couple of years ago described me as mumsy. And I, at the time, was not best pleased because I'd gone from being minxy as a younger woman to being mumsy. Wow. But,
and suddenly cross that line without anyone really telling you.
Like, how does that even happen? But actually, I am finding it really much easier to inhabit that kind of... I got another review a couple of years ago which said, Lucy Porter's comedy is middle-aged, middle-class and middle of the road. And I don't think the reviewer intended that as a compliment, but I embraced that. And I was like, yeah, do you know what? That's fine. So, yeah, it's kind of its whimsical observation and the occasional surreal flight of fancy. Yeah. But again, I mean, I don't think... You know, I sort of wish I knew what I did a bit better, but,
Is how unequivocally jolly you are, which enables you to say some quite offensive things.
Mm.
I think I love that. It's like you can be really rude to your audience.
Yeah, not always intentionally.
But because you're being really jolly about it and smiling. It just works beautifully.
Yeah, I mean, that is a trick as old as time, isn't it? That sort of be nice to people so you can slag them off. Although, Sarah...
Are you like that in real life?
Well, Sarah Millican made a very good point, which is that you're really making a rod for your own back if you have a friendly and approachable stage persona, because then you can only be a disappointment off stage. Whereas if you're Jack D, everybody goes, oh my God, I met Jack D and he was lovely. Oh, he's so different to what
really
he seems to be
point.
On stage.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be my advice to aspiring stand-ups, is just be as unpleasant as possible on stage. Be Jerry Sadovitz, and then if people meet you, then they'll go, oh,
only
surprisingly
go,
not... Yeah, didn't get their cock out, so that's, you know, it's a bonus.
This, right here, in your ears right this very now, this is the Failing Writers Podcast.
So, Lucy, you're back on tour now, aren't you? Are you actually, have you started your tour? I mean, I know you you did a show in Edinburgh, didn't you?
Yeah, well, what I've done really cleverly is I did the show in Edinburgh in August, and then I'm leaving the tour until next March just to give myself long enough to completely forget everything and for it to become completely irrelevant.
Make it fresh.
So yeah, to have to basically rewrite it all over again like I did the last one. So yeah, so that's great.
So it's called Wake Up Call. What's it about? Sell it to us, Lucy.
No, I refuse. That's that's one of the...
Actually, you don't have to sell it to me because I've already bought my ticket.
No, you haven't.
I have. You're coming to Ilkley and I'm...
Oh, so you didn't want to promo it. You just wanted to check you actually still wanted to go. Is that what you're saying? Tell us a little bit about it. Because I'm still within the refund period.
Yeah, I'm definitely coming.
I could just save you a trip out, actually. You could. Oh, well, that would be lovely. I love Ilkley as well.
I'm going to get really drunk and heckle you. So I'm looking forward to that.
You would be the nicest heckler ever. You would be terrible at it.
Go on, Lucy, you're doing great.
Yeah, that was really funny. That's not heckling, John. It's just supporting.
That is cheerleading, technically. Yeah. Especially if you do a high kick, and I would insist that you do a high kick at the end. But yeah, I don't know what the show's going to be yet, I'll be honest with you. And that probably won't sell many tickets. But...
What was it like in Edinburgh?
Well, it's a sort of midlife crisis show, but because it's an ongoing sort of slow car crash of a midlife crisis rather than sort of...
And where do you get your inspiration for that?
Indeed the misery. I sort of have shied away in the past from doing stuff that's too kind of middle-agedy, just because, you know, as I say, I mean, obviously I am, and I'm mumsy, and I'm middle-aged, middle-class, middle of the road and whatever, but I've sort of always shied away from it a little bit, and then I just fully embraced it this year. So it is absolutely about the physical and mental depredations of ageing, and it's largely me absolutely slagging off my husband, which, again, like, young comedians always hate this, and I remember when I was a young comedian, and I used to look at older comedians slagging off their spouses or partners, and I was like, oh God, that is so sad. Just get a divorce. God, you know. And now I and my audience really enjoy that because my audience has kind of grown up with me, and we've all been married for long enough to just go, God, this is, I mean, it's misery, it's hell, but it's what we've chosen and we secretly quite enjoy it.
I want to ask you about the material on that, because you are very much sort of a storytelling anecdote comedian. How much of the stuff that ends up in the act, that ends up in the story, is true, and how much embellishment and comedy writing do you need to put into it generally?
Well, it's all got a kernel of truth within. But I mean, there's massive license there, but I'm always very open. If people come up to me afterwards and say which bits are true and which aren't, I can always tell you. And basically, the funny bits aren't true, and the tragic, desperately angry bits are. And there is a lot of embellishment. But also, here's a little writing tip for aspiring stand-ups. I learned early on that if you're going to tell a story and you can make it about yourself, then that's always the best way to tell it. Because I used to, if a friend of mine had a particularly funny story, I'd say, oh, can I tell that on stage? And I would say, oh, yeah, my mate Margaret did this thing and da-da-da. And then I think somebody said to me, it might have been Ed Byrne. Ed Byrne gave me a lot of very good advice in the early days. And said, look, why are you saying my mate? Because nobody knows your mate. Just say it happened to you. Like, what's to lose? You know, nobody in the audience is going to know that it didn't actually happen to you. And so I do that. I do quite liberally steal from my friends and I tell them.
Right.
But then I say that this thing happened to me. And I think that is acceptable because it's a true story. I have just sort of, I mean, also, I think you can tell stories about other people if you create a world and you establish them as a character. And that's something I quite enjoy doing. And I think, again, that's a really lovely thing to do. In any writing, obviously, establishing a world and world building is so important. And with stand-up, I think, you know, particularly when you've got a longer show, so like when I do an hour in Edinburgh or like an hour and a half, an hour and 40 on tour, then you've really got the chance to, like, now, because I live in a very sort of funny little suburban street and everything, I will, you know, my neighbour Les gets, you know, a chance to shine, and I sort of create him as a character and some of the mums from school. And so that's really nice. But generally, a story will have more impact if you say that that it's your personal experience rather than it's a secondhand anecdote. Yeah. But also the other thing about the world building thing, which I guess might be you know, again, I'm sort of trying to think for people who've got no interest in writing stand-up, but, you know, what might be useful. I do think when I've tried to write other things like sitcoms or books and stuff, if you're struggling with the character, a really useful exercise is to write a stand-up routine for them or think how they would describe themselves and what's funny about them, what they find funny about themselves, what you find funny about them from the outside that they don't get. Because again, that's a lot of stand-up is allowing the audience to laugh at you, sometimes sort of playing along with the joke that you don't get it. Do you know what I mean? So that sort of thing of your foibles and your inadequacies and your outrage that people think you're an idiot. And obviously the joke is that the whole audience thinks you're an idiot, the whole world would think you're an idiot. So I kind of enjoy that. And I think in terms of developing character, that's kind of useful in other things as well, just to think, how are people deceiving themselves? And writing it in stand-up is a really useful way to do it, because then it lets you realise how self-aware they are.
That's very good.
That's an interesting idea.
You mentioned then in a moment, you were talking about writing other things. And I was going to ask you about, you wrote a play a while back.
I did.
Called The Fair Intellectual Club.
I did, yes.
It sounds like a brilliant concept for a play. What was the experience like writing the play? And because I think you were involved in the actual production as well. Is that
yeah,
right?
So the idea for that, so I have struggled my entire life with doing anything other than stand-up, because everything else involves deadlines and sending things to people. And I was really lucky, again, mentoring and, you know, people who can encourage you are the most important thing, I think, in writing. So I found a woman called Marilyn Imrie, the genesis of it, sorry, this is a bit long and boring, but I was reading a book about Scottish history, and I came across this story of a club called the Fair Intellectual Club, which was these girls in the early 1700s who had sort of seen the way that their brothers and male family members were studying really exciting things. You know, this is sort of just early Enlightenment. It's especially in Edinburgh, you know, like Edinburgh was this sort of massive hub of university life and intellectual pursuits. Yeah. And so they were sort of looking at their brothers studying maths and sciences, and they got really frustrated that they couldn't do that. So they set up this club, which was dedicated to sort of improving their minds and reading literature and studying other things. And they had to meet in secret because, you know, obviously girls being educated in anything other than painting and drawing and singing was frowned upon. And so they wrote this manifesto. And so there was this little tiny mention in a history book, and I found the manifesto that they had written and decided to write a play about it. And I mentioned it in an interview with someone for Radio Scotland when I was up promoting my show in Edinburgh. And like, I know myself, over the years I've tried to write stuff and it would never have come to anything, but somebody heard it and put me in touch with this woman, Marilyn Imrie, who was the most incredible producer. She'd produced loads and loads of radio stuff. She'd produced all Stanley Baxter's stuff for years and years. And she just kind of got in touch and drew a play out of me, like absolutely sat me down and forced me to write it. And then I booked a little slot at the Fringe in 2014, I think. And we did it there and it went very well. And then we did a little tour with it. And then Radio 4 commissioned a 6-part sitcom based on it, which was the first time I'd ever tried to write more than a sort of pilot. I'd written a few pilots and stuff, but, you know, to write a whole kind of 6 half-hours for radio was an amazing opportunity.
And when did that go out?
A lot. I'm going to say 2016, because how are you going to challenge me? You don't know.
There's no fact checkers here.
No. That's abundantly clear from your podcast. You're not checking anything. So
absolutely. You could literally say anything.
And then we performed it on the moon and Elon Musk was in it. Yeah. It was an amazing time. So I did that with Marilyn, and then, you know, that sort of was such a nice feeling of achievement and accomplishment to actually have written a play and a 6-part radio sitcom.
So have you got the urge to write more?
I have the massive urge, always the urge, and nothing more than an urge. Just huge urging.
Dangerous things, those urges, can't they? They really can.
But yeah, so, and sadly, Marilyn is no longer with us, and, you know, which is a huge blow to the arts in general and to me very personally and specifically, because she was an incredible muse and mentor. So I just, I need to find another Marilyn, basically, because I think, you know, one of the hardest things, because even if your friends are encouraging and, like, my agent is sort of part cheerleader, part tough lover, mostly on the tough love side, I would say. but, you know, it's very difficult to find someone who really will motivate you to do stuff.
Someone who can drive things along.
I mean, I think if it's novels, you know, I mean, getting an agent, I think, is an amazing thing to do if you can. And I know everyone always sort of talks, like, whenever I've been at writing events and stuff, it's such a big question for everyone is, you know, should you get an agent? What kind of agent should you get? And I have to say, in terms of stand-up, having an agent has been unbelievably helpful, because it's someone to take some of the pressure of the admin side of things off, which I am terrible at, as you know. but it also is, just sort of feeling like there is someone else fighting your corner is amazing. And if you can get an agent or an editor, or just being part of... I did do a playwriting course at the National Theatre for a bit, and that was really great, because then you've got your cohort of other writers who, you know, you kind of cheer each other on. But I think really, I mean, ideally getting a producer or someone who wants to do stuff with you. I mean, obviously, that's the best thing. Obviously, that's what we're all striving for.
This is the Failing Writers Podcast. And the sad thing is, there's nothing much you can do about it. So
can we ask you about your podcast, Lucy?
You can. I'd be delighted to talk about it. I love podcasting. I feel like I've always loved radio, speech radio, and, like, this is just such a golden time to be alive, because podcasts are everything I absolutely love. And so I do one with my friend Jenny Ryan, who people may know as the Vixen off of The Chase, who, again, actually, she's done really well, because she's got a persona of being an absolute stone-cold, hard-nosed horror on that show, and she's actually delightful. So, you know, people always say, oh, isn't she lovely? And I'm like, yes, so am I.
She's the only one.
Yes, I'm lovely too.
I expected you to
be listening to her the other day say that if it sounds like someone's about to say the wrong answer, she has to put her fingers in her ears.
Oh, I know. She's a very deeply caring and lovely human being, despite her on-screen persona. And she's a massive quiz nerd. So, I mean, I am nerdy about comedy, and I am very nerdy about quizzing, and I love to quiz. And again, I think there's a real, like, a lot of writers and certainly a lot of comedians, that sort of puzzle solving, trivia seeking thing of, like, you know, like, most writers, if, you know, if you're anything like me, the best bit of writing is doing the research and, you know, reading the books and not the actual sitting down and putting finger to keyboard. So yeah, I love to know ridiculous facts. And so, and also, I grew up with, you know, a golden era of quizzing, because we had things like Bullseye,
I was making
gold.
The kids watch Bullseye the other day. They loved it. I tell you what though, we watched the first ever episode, and it was so different. It was like a proper pilot. The board was a different colour. Tony wasn't there to do the calling on the scores and stuff.
Everything was made of paper.
It was just like really like,
they had no darts. They just used to run at the board with their heads.
They just called out a number. They just relied on honesty. You just had to say, oh, double two. Oh, never mind.
They still
no catch phrase or anything. Yeah. And then so we watched that one, and I said, kids, you need to watch a later one. And then we watched one where the...
it gets better after season three.
Yeah,
like Seinfeld. It really hits its stride,
But it's brilliant. I mean, Bullseye, I used to love Bullseye. Every second counts. Do you remember that one with Paul Daniels?
I've got the board game of that. When we get together in person, I'll bring the Every Second Counts board game, because it's actually really good.
What am I thinking? Blankety Blank. That was one of my favourites.
Still good. I mean, those formats never die, because I watched the one with Bradley Walsh recently, and it's still, you know, it's timeless. Yeah. And those great formats really are timeless. And I mean, with Bullseye, I think they do keep trying to revive you know, Bullseye, and they'll do the snooker one. They'll do the Jim Davidson.
Big break.
Yes, and Jim Davidson. Yeah.
Misread general knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, and the I've got actually one of John Virgo's waistcoats that I bid for on eBay, and it was someone whose husband had won it back in the 80s. But, you know, yeah, so we talk all on the podcast, we talk all about our favourite old formats, and then we interview some of the hosts, and like we had Henry Kelly on talking about Going for Gold, which was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Les Dennis talking about Family Fortunes and Northside. Yeah. So yeah, I just absolutely love it. But we're living in another golden era of quiz now, because we have The Chase, Beat the Chasers, Pointless.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's amazing. There's so much quiz on telly. Yeah.
So how did you meet your co-host? How did you meet Jenny? Was it was that actually on the quiz itself?
It was, yes. I was on the Celebrity Chase with Krishnan Gurumurthy, Jay Rayner and Steve Davis. Lovely men, all of them. Especially Steve Davis. I mean,
Steve Davis.
Again, if your persona is boring, then you can actually... He's amazing. He's an EDM DJ.
That was all like created by Barry Hearn, wasn't it? Like this, his sort of boring persona.
Which was a masterstroke, because at the time, everybody else was quite interesting. So if you've got Hurricane Higgins, you can't compete with that. So go the other way. Again, you know, it's like being a stand-up. You've got to find your niche, and what do people want at the moment? What's the thing? And so, yeah, so we were all on the chase together, and... it was, I mean, we won a lot of money. I don't like to talk about it, but we did brilliantly. Anne was
our
chaser.
Did you have to give it to charity, though?
Oh, do you know, this is one of the things I lament is that I am now at the level of fame where I'm sort of famous enough to be on the celebrity versions of quiz shows, but I'm also at the level of fame where people don't realise it's the celebrity version. So I did get, one of my neighbours had seen me on Pointless, and they went, oh, you won, you know, £5,000. What are you going to do? Do with it? And I was like, well, I've given it to charity. And they were like, oh, that's amazing. And I was like, no, I was contractually obliged. I would have loved that money.
I didn't have any choice. I always think it's weird with the celebrity ones, though, where they go, like, you know, you could win up to £10,000 for charity, and then they get on and you do it and you get the last question wrong, and they go, oh, you've blown it, you've got nothing. There's someone there at the TV station going, hey, well, we get to keep that 10 grand then. We don't have to give it to the sick kids, do we?
Poor charity. Well, I did another celebrity chase, which was a Christmas Day one. And we recorded it in like April, and there was a Christmas tree up, and we were all absolutely baking, wearing Christmas jumpers, sweating cobs. But the... So it was me, one of the Speakmans off This Morning, and Arge from TOWIE and Kate Thornton. And although we did very well, but Mark Labette, the Beast, was our chaser, and he did even better. And so it was Christmas Day. I was with all my family, all my in-laws, and we sat down, you know, to watch it. And it's so tragic. It's like Christmas Day. Everything's about charity. And the thing is, although we lost, they still do the glitter drop. So we're all standing there. Poor little Arch from TOWIE was practically in tears, and we're standing there with glitter raining down on our sad faces, with charities up and down the land missing out on thousands of pounds. But that's the nature of the beast, you know. And people always say, like, Jenny gets so much stick for, people always say to Jenny, oh, you know, well, why don't you let them win, it's for charity. And it's like, well, that would be the worst television
and sometimes they do try and let people win by giving them really easy questions.
But some people as well are stupid, aren't they, with it, during like some... When you see, when you're shouting at the TV.
I suspect, though, it's very different when you're there and you kind of know the answer, but you can't say it, or I don't know, something just happens to your brain.
Yeah, you do freeze a bit under the lights, but also there are some very, very thick celebrities who do just go on it because their agent has said, like, there was one, I shall not name them, but there was one reality TV star I was on a quiz show with, and it was so funny because, like, absolutely no interest in being there, no interest in quizzing. You know, it was just like, why has your agent put you through this? Because it was just misery from start to finish. But it was, but again, it made good telly, because actually,
still pretty funny.
Yeah, you want people to get really stupid things.
So, how much do you love quizzes, Lucy, on a scale of 1 to 10?
If I basically, when I got into comedy, I thought I loved comedy. And now I've sort of realised the only reason I still like doing comedy is because it allows me to do the so-called celebrity versions of quiz shows. Because that's the only TV I do now. I'm not on any telly programmes apart from quizzes, but I love it. I absolutely love it. Long may it continue.
Did you not experience any sort of COVID-related quiz burnout? Because it seemed to be the only way that people spoke to each other for a good few months was by doing Zoom quizzes.
Yeah, but I mean, I would have done one every single night of the week. And we got to the point with ours where we were doing, so Jenny is brilliant at coming up with novelty rounds. So we were sort of not doing so much general knowledge and sport and all that sort of thing. Yeah. We were doing things like getting old Argos catalogues and you had to guess the price of the thing in the old Argos catalogue.
Well, we had some good ones, didn't we, John? I mean, we did try and invite Dave on the quiz, but he refused.
We did, actually.
He was quizzed out by then.
I just had enough.
And I think that's one legacy of lockdown that I would really like at some point when we're all sort of feeling a bit less bruised to all pool our best quiz show rounds and do a sort of mega quiz.
Hey, that's good.
Quiz.
That's a good idea for a TV show. That
yes.
Be,
hello.
Isn't it?
Shall we? Shall we pitch?
Go around the country and put people's best rounds
out. Yes. Well, I mean, I think there was sort of talk at the time of, you know, oh, everybody's got so into quizzing and we could call in on other people's Zoom quizzes. But no. I think, you know, some of these things are best kept. Because actually, the funniest rounds.
There were a couple of rounds that we came up with that definitely weren't for sharing.
Yes.
That were just within a closed circle, and that's where they still stay forever.
Yes, it would be the quickest, the fastest cancelled show of all time if we put some along.
So, I mean, would you fancy doing a quick quiz now? If we'd set one up somehow.
Do you know, I thought you would never ask.
Yeah, we have got a quiz for you.
Oh, you are lovely.
This is we call this the Like a Quiz Show But Shorter Lucy Porter quiz. And it is a quiz all about you. So all of these questions are taken from material available on your website. So it should be incredibly easy.
No.
And you've got absolutely no excuse to get a single one wrong.
If anyone should know the answer to these questions.
Yeah, I'm not really me. That's the thing. As you know, I said I steal other people's anecdotes. I've actually stolen someone else's persona.
Ah.
Unfortunately, because you're a celebrity, you can't actually win anything in this. But if you get all the questions right, we will give £12.80 to a charity of our choice.
I believe you.
So the pressure's on. Now, like a quiz show
but shorter, Lucy Porter quiz. So let's start the completely inconsequential timer, and we're off. Lucy Porter, you have interacted with two puppet foxes in your celebrity career. Could you tell me who they were?
Oh my goodness, this is what a trip down memory lane. Yes, Basil Brush is, of course, one of them. I mean, you could count Jenny the Vixen Fox as well.
Yeah, of course.
Is she a puppet?
Oh, sorry. Well,
or not.
I've had my hand up a few times. Let's not go there. And then the other one was when I did an absolutely terrible advert. I was young and I needed the money for Cell Phones For You or something it was called. And they had Harry Hill had been doing these adverts with a puppet fox. And people had said, these are the worst adverts we have ever seen. Why would Harry Hill deign to do this? He's a brilliant comedian. And then I did them and everyone was like, God, these are even worse and we don't even know who this woman is. So it was humiliating in every way.
It is brilliant. I saw that's on an episode of We Like Old Adverts that you were on in which you reveal the ad, it was a gleeful moment. Because the three of us, we're voiceovers and we've brought a selection of the UK's worst ever commercials to life at some point in our careers. you're in good company.
I think I was so embarrassed about it at the time. And even until relatively recently, I would have said, oh my God, I hope no one ever digs that up. But again, the beauty of middle age is that nothing embarrasses you. You don't care. And it's, you know, it bought me a bit of artistic freedom at the time. And it's quite kitsch fun now. So
I think that's good that you're not embarrassed about it because there's a link in our show notes.
I would like it to be spread even more widely. So the millions of listeners you have, I will be delighted that they'll get to see it.
Okay, next question, Dave.
Question two, Lucy. If you were on a date and suddenly realised you drunk a bit too much.
Oh, no.
What would be your go-to receptacle to be sick into?
Oh, okay. Now, when I was on Would I Lie to You, one thing I do regret is that I didn't think of some better stories. And this was one, which is a true story about me throwing up into a handbag on a date. And it's like, I think sometimes with comedy, you don't consider that your aunties have televisions. And that they're going to be watching you in Ireland and you're going to have to then face them and say, yeah, that was a true story. But yeah, so that's a regrettable, but both a regrettable incident and regrettable that I chose to share it more widely. Yeah. So let's move on. You can watch the ad, but don't watch that.
Fair enough.
Question three. What noise do octopi make during coitus?
Ooh. I'm doing it now. Why have I ever...
I suppose it depends whether you grab them by the tentacle.
I mean, I love octopi. You're going to have to enlighten me as to... Have I ever talked about this?
I think it was from a QI clip from memory. I think it was basically quite a squelchy noise.
One would think so. They're very, very intelligent. You'd think they'd be too intelligent to indulge in all that sort of nonsense.
What did you put into room 101?
Oh, okay, yes. So, two of them, fairly uncontroversial. Child actors, but particularly with reference... well, I mean, there were just all sorts of child... But child actors generally, and marriage proposals, sort of extravagant flash mob style, public marriage proposals. And I stand by both of those. And then the other thing I put in was Formula One. And I have never faced so much hostility because it turns out people quite like that silly little sport of men driving around doing nonsense. And just huge backlash. And I got, I fell out with Leo Sayer.
Blimey.
because he's such a Formula One fan, which I had no idea about. But we're sworn enemies now.
Goodness.
Question whatever number it is, your podcast co-host Jenny, as we've mentioned from the chairs, has medically interesting feet.
Does she? Well, can I phone a friend? Is that allowed on this podcast?
What was it about them that was particularly sensational?
Did she have an extra toe or something? I've got no idea.
He's done his research.
I mean, I've been up close and personal with Jenny's feet. Not even, you know.
Well, she's... She had this thing removed, so they are no longer medical.
It's going to be an extra toe or webbing, isn't it? I mean, those are the two choices.
It was a large ganglion, apparently.
Ooh.
Whatever that. It sounds dangly, doesn't it? A ganglion.
It does sound like it should be more gynecological than it is, but well, she is a medical miracle in so many ways.
I mean, the worrying thing is we've still got like three or four questions left, and this is...
I've done quite badly, actually, haven't I?
This is where John's research has got to so far. So, God knows what's coming
Well,
next.
Let's go for it. What food do you seem to have strong feelings about?
Well, all of it. I mean, I adore it. Cheese. Is this cheese?
Related to your husband, Justin.
Okay. I mean, oh, God, he likes horrible, awful things. He likes Marmite. He likes pickled... Is it pickled walnuts? Is it a pickled walnut?
No, it's something you mentioned that he, for some reason, just decided you didn't like.
Oh, coconut. Yeah.
There you go.
No, that was our early courting where he'd obviously been out with someone before who doesn't like coconut and kept every time we went to a restaurant would say, we could get that. Oh, no, let's not because it's got coconut in it. You don't like coconut. And I did end up in the middle of a Thai restaurant one night going, I like coconut. I love it. And really sort of alarming people. But yeah, he also didn't know that I was left-handed until about 3 or 4 years into our marriage.
Wow.
It's lovely that you can keep surprising each other like that, isn't it?
Yeah, saw you throwing those coconuts about. I went, oh, bloody hell, join the dots.
So she is.
Well, and finally then, you were once invited onto Woman's Hour, but the runner accidentally took you to the wrong studio. What Radio 4 show did you almost end up being an accidental guest on, discussing Galen, the ancient Greek
it's
physician?
It's one of my all-time favourite days. It was, I was in a bit of a rush. I was late, as I always am, for everything. And this
we haven't noticed that.
No,
hasn't
I know.
Come up before,
I'm so reliable to you, but. This lovely researcher came down and just grabbed me out of BBC reception and whisked me up to a studio. And in the lift, she was saying things to me like, oh, have you got your notes? And I was going on, I can't remember what I was talking about on Woman's Hour, but it was something so desperately trivial. It was like, you know, what hobbies do you share with your boyfriend? Oh, no, I tell you what it was. No, I do know. It was about, there was a thing on Mumsnet about someone who had a sex beaker where they kept a tumbler of water beside the bed, and after they'd had relations, her husband would wash his private parts in this beaker of water, and everyone had said how disgusting it was. And so anyway, so I was just on to talk about that, and so this and this researcher was kind of going, oh, so have you brought your notes? And I was like, why would I have notes to talk about someone's mucky beaker, penis beaker, that was what it was called. And then she showed me into the studio, and sat there was not own, you know, the very man Lord Bragg of the Lake District, wherever he is. And I was so shocked, I kind of sat down and this researcher disappeared. And I was, and it was like, it's a live show, and it was minutes away from going on air with me. And talking about regrets in my life, the biggest regret is that didn't actually happen, because can you imagine how epic it would have been?
It sounds like that guy, was he like a taxi driver or something? He was on
Guy Gomer. That was my Guy Gomer moment, yeah. Oh, if anyone's not seen Guy Gomer, that is, put the link to that in the notes, because that is...
His little face, it's just that look on his face. When it all just slots in, he's like...
He gets sudden sweat, doesn't he?
But he does such a good job.
He really goes for it, doesn't
he? He does such a good job. I think we should get him into government. Yeah, make him Prime Minister.
Well, you failed that quiz. We don't have to give the £12.80 charity.
So that's it. And I'll do my own glitter drop here. I've got some glitter.
We'll have some children
crying. I'm glittering down on my sad face. That's it. I'm sorry, Carers UK or Action for Starving Children or whoever. But it was fun, though, and thank you. I do appreciate that. That's a lovely little bit of quizzing joy for me. So I'm very grateful.
Well, you're very welcome.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you,
Lucy.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been brilliant.
Thank you so much for having me. And, any time I can do anything to make up for my terrible, my terrible lack of organisational skills, then please let me know.
Well, that's very kind of you. I think I've actually written you a little song, Lucy, which I think we'll play out with, if that's okay with you.
A quiz and a song. This is Christmas and birthday.
We really go for it. Oh.
She's got a smile like a radiator, makes you feel so warm, which in these days of see you later money is enormous benefits. Cause she could cook Eggs Benedict with just her wits. Probably she's just 4'11", so her stand-up comedy can occasionally resemble something more akin to kneeling comedy. But her personality seems more like 7'3". Lucy Porter, I'm glad we caught you, cos you're nice to talk to. Get your ticket for a tour, cos I'll bet you all a bunch that after this podcast you'll be selling out for months and months and months and months and months and months and months. And that's a lot of months. Lucy Porter, I'm glad we caught you, cos you're nice to talk to.
Well, when I write my sitcom, the theme tune is...
You're nowhere to come.
No, that is the most flattering, lovely thing that's happened to me for many, many years. So I'm honestly...
Now play the version you wrote after she didn't turn up that time, John.
Yeah. No, I can imagine that one. That was such a pleasure. Thank you so, so much.
Pleasure is all ours.
Yeah, thank you so much. We've taken loads of your time. Thank you.
Cheers, you too.
Thanks, Lucy.
Bye. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. And she was actually lovely to talk to.
She was.
Because if she hadn't been, that song would have made no sense whatsoever, would it?
There was a lot riding on that.
There really was, yeah. Bloody hell. What a relief. Good old Lucy Porter. Well, you know, some things are just worth waiting for.
And, exactly.
We did have to wait quite a long time, but it was worth it in the end.
So, yeah, so go, go see her. She's touring all over, and she's excellent. So, yeah.
Well, you already are, yeah. John, aren't you?
I already am.
Yeah, already got your tickets.
Yeah, I'm off in February, I think it is, mid-February or something. But, yeah, she's flying all over the place. She's up north, and she's back down south, and she's back up north again. So, yeah, check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes if you want to find out where she is. And yeah, that was great.
It's interesting,
wasn't it?
To hear, isn't it, about, because we've talked about lots of different types of writing, but I think Lucy's way of writing seems the least writing-y way that we've talked about.
Seems good, that, doesn't it? Just kind of like thinking things and making a few notes.
I don't think I could do that.
I think I do a lot of that. I just don't have the end product at the end of it. I do a lot of the thinking things.
I mean, we've all got anecdotes and things, but I think it's a case of, it is that consciously turning something that is an anecdote into, like, knowing it's going to be a joke and trying it out on people.
Crafting it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Interesting. I think I'd have to write it down.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Well, that's kind of what I did on a few occasions.
There's a danger of taking all the spark out.
Well,
of
exactly.
Them,
you've got to learn it enough to be able to not think about it anymore.
Yeah.
But then actors do that, don't they? Actors.
Yeah,
learn
true,
lines
yeah.
and then keep it fresh every night somehow.
So you just got to do whatever suits you.
Exactly. It's interesting, though, because we've actually, well, I don't know if you guys have, but I think, Tom, you had a little go of writing a little bit of stand-up, and I had a go already. I thought that writing generally was hard, but stand-up is like another level because it's all got to be funny. And the other thing that I found is that the material, I think we sort of mentioned this in the interview, but the material's so tightly woven with the performance that you can't really separate the two. Do you know what I mean? It sort of almost has to come out fully formed when you're thinking about the performance.
And you need an audience, don't you?
Yeah, that's it.
Just doing it dry doesn't work either. It's
how not, do you know if something's funny? You know, you could.
You say something and that's funny, and then you go down that road a bit further and you milk that a bit more without the audience. You've not got any of that, have you? Just kind of like,
that's right, because it's a two-way thing. You're sort of feeding off each other.
Yeah,
right,
but you've kind of got to be able to. You've got to have the confidence as well. If you do something, if you say a bit that you've written it down and you've crafted it and honed it and rehearsed it and you've got it all ready, and then you do it and it doesn't work, you've got to have resilience and confidence to be able to keep going and do the next bit, and still keep that sort of performance.
It's hard, that, though. We've all seen comedians where they're just dying, and you can see it in their eyes, and it's just so painful to watch. Yeah. And it's very hard to put your finger on specifically what it is that's going badly wrong, but it's just the relationship has broken down somehow. I don't know.
Lucy said something, didn't she, about people make a decision really quickly as to whether you like a comedian. I think that's really true. Because I think if you get on side with a comic when you see them, after a while, it stops mattering so much what they say. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like some people, like she was talking about Peter Kay being this phenomenon. Once you get into a Peter Kay set, there are moments where it just doesn't. He could just be making noises. It doesn't really matter because you're sort of into a kind of mode where he says something in a certain way and you laugh.
So it's a real gift, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Some people definitely have. Some people are almost able to say anything. I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it, to describe what it is. Like Billy Connolly, he's just got a way about him. He's got like a joy about him.
Yeah.
And some of the things he says aren't like hysterically funny, but his delivery is so good. It's sort of, I don't know.
Yeah, well, there's just like a pattern to it, isn't it? That you just know that when you get to the end of that string of notes.
Yeah, it is.
You laugh. You laugh at the end
of it. Yeah, that is
there
good.
There's people like, I seem to remember reading Lee Evans' autobiography, and he became a comedian by accident. He was trying to be a musician.
Oh, really?
And he was just, he did like an open mic thing when he was doing some sort of music, and it all went so horribly wrong that people were just laughing at him. And he went, oh, right, I wonder if I could make a career out of this, and he did. And Tommy Cooper used to get really annoyed at the fact that people would not take him seriously. Because everything that he said, people would just laugh. So, like, he couldn't make a serious point. Yeah,
oh, that's good.
Like, even when he died, everyone thought it was a joke.
So, the big question is, fellas, are we going to have a go at writing some stand-up?
Do you know what, but I don't think, from what I said, I don't think we can. I don't think it can exist
because we don't have an audience.
We need to do an open mic night next season.
Yeah, it's got to be live, hasn't it?
Otherwise, I don't like the idea.
I know you don't, but that's literally the only way to do it. Just read.
Well, we essentially did. We did a live improvised story night, John, which is basically the most difficult type of stand-up you can do.
Yeah, but when I got confused or didn't know what to say, I just looked at Tom and he started talking. So I'd have to bring Tom out on the stage with me.
Well, there we go. There's the act. Job done.
Yeah. we walk on, look at Tom, you just, and go from there.
Yeah. Tommy deals with my... Yeah, you could be my bouncer. That could be the whole shtick. You could be like... You deal with the hecklers.
Can I be the heckler? In that Planting scenario. The audience,
you could be.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So it's just going to be the three of us, basically.
No, I think it has to have an audience in it, because it would just be utterly dead.
Yeah, it would make
Someone
more
just
sense.
Came and did some stand-up.
I think whatever you did wouldn't be funny, would it?
No.
Really? Whatever I did, Tommy, you
say. Not so specific. That was a general. That was a very general thing. But now you mentioned it, yeah. No, generally, you know, you need a...
No, I think you're right,
You need that situation, you need that club, you need the pint.
Even if we can hear each other chuckling at what we're saying, it's not quite the same, is it?
Still not the same, no.
Interesting. So,
well done for signing up for that, John. We'll look forward to that. I know that'll be something that you relish.
So that's season six, right, are you saying?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, cool.
With a new lineup,
So in the more immediate future... what else have we got going on? What's coming up next week?
Well, we don't quite know. We've potentially got a guest, but...
But we might not have a guest, but we have other plans anyway. So it's
fluid.
Very much a up in the air. Turn up and see.
So what essentially what you're saying is that over the course of this series, we've learnt nothing about preparation. that makes sense. Yep.
No, hang on, Dave. We've got two episodes prepared.
We just don't know which one's coming. It's Schrodinger's episode.
Right, yes.
There you go.
Okay, so all right. Well, good. Well, I look forward to either, both, or neither of them.
Righty-ho. Take care, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for joining in, and catch you next time.
And thanks again to Lucy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bye, then.
I've both said bye. Bye.
Bye.
Weird pause that time.
Right. Is that an octopus?
An octopus.
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?